The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, you know, the rain in Spain this week is mainly causing pain.
Well, the massive capital flight from Spain over the last 2 months has been on a scale I don't think we've ever seen before in Spain.
Right.
And so it is interesting. $50 to $70 billion per month.
How?
Has been leaving Spain and moving to other jurisdictions.
So this is a different type of running of the bulls.
Maybe the running of the bears, but you don't really have a huge bear population in Spain. But yeah, this is private capital that would rather be somewhere else. German bonds, Swiss paper. In fact, the Swiss National Bank has even suggested capital controls to limit the inflow of money coming from other European countries.
You know, David, what strikes me as interesting is we just finished reading the book Bonhoeffer, and we looked at Germany as it was starting to go towards more of a war footing. And usually when you see these types of flight capital moments, they're not economic. They're usually precursor to war. Isn't this interesting that we have almost like a financial war or an economic World War III occurring without the military?
Well, it is interesting because I think, frankly, the conflicts that we will see over the next 3 to 5 years will be less about tanks and bombs and guns and more about financial maneuvers. Which you look at on the basis of contract law, you look at on the basis of opportunity lost or opportunity gained, and it is a very different calculus, but it's still aggressive in nature, and we've seen a massive move already towards natural resources in Africa, this is China primarily, and into hotspots which would otherwise be considered uninteresting or intolerable for anyone with a conscience. So we will not be acquiring oil in Sudan. We will not be acquiring minerals from certain parts of Africa because we have a conscience, and yet there is that issue of it's just business as far as the Chinese are concerned.
Well, and you know, speaking of just business, going back to Europe, I mean, if the new leadership can't solve this problem, are we looking at some sort of people's revolt, or do the people even have a say anymore?
Right. So raising the issue in Europe, if technocrats and their bureaucratic brothers don't emerge with a workable solution to their core versus sort of the periphery incompatibility, again, that's sort of the spenders versus the savers for a very simplistic analogy, the people will revolt
right.
via capital markets, and that's exactly what we're seeing now.
So flight capital out of the country.
And that's a form of revolt. It's saying this isn't going to work for us. We don't feel safe here anymore. Even if this is our home country, we're feeling at risk.
Well, let me ask you a question, though. If all that money is leaving the country, I mean, any country, what happens to the tax revenues? I mean, the very thing that these countries actually use to churn out partially paying the debt, it looks like even that's leaving.
Well, you're gutting the ability of select countries to generate enough revenue to even maintain the status quo. Once your tax base has moved on, there's nothing for you to do but introduce radical measures. That's aggressive inflation,
right?
You know, hampered by the currency union today, but that may not be an issue for certain countries in the Eurozone tomorrow. You've got nationalization of assets as an alternative,
right.
or complete capital controls. And it's important to remember that capital controls were in place in Europe for 30 to 40 years leading up to the early 90s, which was very indicative of the populace's lack of trust in the system.
Well, and it was that lack of trust in the system that it took decades for them to build on to finally bring them into this euro. Now it seems like it's fracturing back out again and going back to that distrust that we remember when we were kids.
Right. Well, we've discussed capital controls ad nauseum. In retrospect, looking at that 30 to 40 year period leading up to the EU and the European Monetary Union, you always had the movement of capital, and it was very fluid, sometimes on a black market basis, but capital controls were required as a partial solution. And we've discussed this ad nauseum. Capital controls are the future here, and likely in Europe as well. And it's worthy of note that prior to conscription of capital comes the closing of the gates, locking as much capital inside as possible.
So basically just making it impossible to move money in or out. If you are a citizen of Spain or a citizen, well, let's just use the United States. At some point it'll probably happen here too, where they just basically put the walls up and say, look, we can't afford for you to take your money out of here.
Well, this was the point of our discussion about the Leviathan, the growth of government several months ago, and the idea that this monster animal will do everything it can to feed itself, to maintain itself, even at the expense of you, whoever you are, whatever jurisdiction you're in. Everyone should think of having a sufficient amount of long-term vacation funding.
Well, you love to go to Europe, David, and you love to go to Asia. So what you're thinking is possibly just bringing the money there first.
But even
taking
Canada.
Taking the vacation later.
Even Canada. There's some beautiful mountains to climb in Canada, some beautiful places to go skiing. And
well, make sure you keep your passports renewed.
Yeah, Kevin, all that we're talking about is above board and legal. You simply don't want to linger on the issue of when any particular treasury around the world feels that they're losing control and thus start grasping at straws.
Well, you know, you were talking, Dave, about how Greece was actually one of the only performing markets last week. So maybe part of the way I get some of that vacation money overseas is I go buy Greek stocks. How's it looking?
Well, we're actually only 1 point above its low for the year.
So does that make
morning.
It a deal?
Not yet. I mean, and this is the nature of a bear market, regardless of the geography. It could be Greece. It could be the U.S. tomorrow. And in fact, we've got a Dow theory bear market confirmation just here in the last week.
Well, you know, Richard Russell sort of picked up the baton. This is a 100-year-old system that goes back to, you know, the beginning stages of the Dow Jones Industrial Average
and
in itself.
Charles Dow, the original creator of those components.
Well, and the baton has been carried by an individual writer all the way through the years, all the way through the 1929 crash after the boom, you know, all the years that we saw, you know, the Dow gold ratio we've talked about wavering back and forth. And, you know, at this point, Richard Russell has been writing about the Dow theory for just about, I think, 50 years.
Oh, and over that, closer to 60. And it's these indicators that have been at the front edge of major declines. You know, we've suggested that a 25% decline may be in the making in the U.S. equity markets, with international equities offering really no solace or comfort due to sort of record high correlations. Everything's moving in one step, one direction at the same time.
And David, you've talked about over the next 24 to 36 months, I mean, the next 2 to 3 years, you're really looking for a substantial decline in the Dow.
Well, that assumes central bank intervention becomes less and less effective. That's in fact what we're seeing right now.
Well, David, the drag about this is if you're not getting double-digit returns, you're actually not keeping up with inflation right now. So, you know, your nominal or your return actually that you're coming away with, whether it's stocks, whether it's bonds, where in the world can a person keep up right now?
In all fairness, let's just say that the official inflation rate is a real-world inflation rate, and all we're dealing with is roughly 2 to 2.5% inflation.
Hmm.
We're talking about single-digit rates of return, low single-digit rates of return in equities over the next several years if they're not negative. And so, in other words, whatever you are seeing in terms of a positive rate of return is still annihilated, even by a low stated rate of inflation, although we'd argue that it's probably higher than that.
Well, and I'd like to talk about this a little bit later, but the correlation in the markets, it's something that you just brought up. And there seems to be an interconnectedness in the markets where diversity doesn't really necessarily pan out, because you could be in the Spanish market, you could be somewhere in Euro, you could also be here buying Facebook, you know.
And they all represent flopbook at this point.
So, David, you know, with what we're seeing in the stock market, or, you know, just not being able to diversify really anywhere right now to get a positive rate of return, is there any way to at least keep up?
Well, I'd remind you that the low to negative rates are the perfect environment for precious metals as investors sort of practice their opt-out of a very poor risk-reward scenario. And as return expectations move to these lower levels, investors are adjusting to low single digits, and again, that inflation bite is more and more dramatic as a component of the real rate of return. What does a person do in light of that frustration? They simply step aside and say, I don't want cash because I can see that the central bank will eat my lunch. I don't want to be in the markets because I can see that that will eat my lunch. And what do you move to? It's a temporary port in the storm.
Okay, but, you know, the market does throw false cues, because there are times when you have these declining markets where you have these rallies that can they can really thrill the audience. Well, I'll tell you what it does. It gets people actually watching financial TV again.
Well, right, and I think we're on the cusp of a relief rally. We've had 18 out of the last 24 days have been down days on the Dow. You've got news pending, the Fed announcement on the 20th, and then you've got the Euro Leaders Conference on the 28th and 29th. These dates, the Fed announcement on the 20th, and then again the Euro Leaders Conference on the 28th and 29th, has the potential for shaping the markets here in the summer months, either positively or negatively. But between now and then, you may see positive expectations. You may see positive expectations drive the market higher.
Well, and I want to ask you about that, because the unemployment numbers, you know, we've heard with past guests that when you have high unemployment, you don't have an incumbent president getting back in, all right? And so we had these employment numbers that came out, and they weren't pleasant. I mean, they were really, really rough, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and we were heading towards that magic 7.4 number. And again, that's the classic dividing line between an incumbent being reelected or not being reelected.
Right.
If the unemployment number is above 7.4, an incumbent's never been reelected in U.S. history.
Right. Now,
however, if it's below that, and we certainly were trending from 10 to 9 to 8 to, and we didn't quite get there, we're moving back up towards 8.2. Kevin, the May numbers, you're right, they weren't pleasant. And in fact, if you look at the revisions lower for the two previous months, it would imply that we've been in a downtrend in terms of employment growth here for several months now, just simply papered over. One of the things that they've used to paper over that reality is the birth-death model, where we had 204,000 jobs added in the most recent numbers. And again, that's just a reminder that this is a statistical add-in.
It's like, how about we add 204,000?
Right,
you know,
well,
let's just add some.
And in fairness, it seasonally either helps or hurts the total net employment numbers. It'd be because that you can add in or you can subtract out on the basis of this birth-death modeling.
Okay, but speaking of papering over, Dave, let me ask you a question. The political pressure on the Federal Reserve, we've seen this in election years, really all of our lives, where the Federal Reserve tends to act in symmetry with what the incumbent wants. And I guess my question to you is this. Are they going to bow to that pressure now and paper over this unemployment number with a lot of inflation?
Yeah, I think part of the danger in our current economic situation, Kevin, is that U.S. leadership is distracted by a pending election. And the best thing that they're going to do is continue to pick up the phone and pressure the Fed and Treasury to do all it can in the face of these deteriorating jobs figures.
Right.
Of course, there's other signs of slowing growth, but the problem is the Fed may or may not play ball. And while we continue to doubt their independence, they are witnessing the quote-unquote do-more interventionism.
Just do something.
It's not actually doing that much.
Yeah.
It's been selectively successful. And we should, in reality, be further along down the road to recovery. We're not. That fact is mildly disconcerting to the Fed. But again, they're not willing to say we've been wrong or our policies have been wrong. They just really don't have an explanation. The fact that they've created $1.6, $1.7 trillion in excess liquidity,
right,
that is not in the economy as it was intended, that is back on their balance sheet, redeposited excess reserves from depository institutions back with the Fed, they're having to scratch their head and say, well, we were willing to create liquidity. We were willing to do everything that we could to monetize debt, to print, to et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But guess what? It's not having an effect.
Okay, so don't hold your breath for a second version of Maestro, maybe Maestro 2 for Ben Bernanke. You know, Alan Greenspan got his book. I'm wondering what Bernanke's book is going to read like.
Yeah, well, you know, and then we have, following the June 20th Fed meeting, we've got the Euro leader meeting at the end of the month. And we anticipate problematic handling of the debt ceiling later in the summer. Again, that's a U.S. issue. And then in the fall, we have the whole issue of the fiscal cliff.
Well, let's explain the fiscal cliff. I mean, what is the fiscal cliff, and why should I be worried about that?
Well, last year an agreement was made that if they couldn't come to an agreement, there would be an automatic downshift in terms of spending, roughly 4% of GDP. And again, the wranglings around the fiscal cliff, the wranglings around raising the debt ceiling, the wranglings around whether the Fed intervenes or doesn't intervene, all of these are potential triggers for a downgrade of U.S. credit. We've already seen the AAA status marred by one rating agency last summer, going from AAA to AA+, and we think that this could, again, be the trigger for an increase in interest rates and, frankly, a larger ratchet down in equities.
Well, you know, and this brings up something from a few weeks ago when we had Richard Duncan on, and he had said, look, guys, you need to understand, this economy for at least four decades has been growing mainly by our ability to borrow more money and spend. Borrow more money and spend. It's the perfect Keynesian approach until it doesn't work. So would you say the greatest risk of the day right now is that debt expansion is not working?
Well, it's this, that one, debt has been expanding for 30 to 40 years.
Yeah.
And that game of growth predicated on credit expansion is over. And in place of it, guess what government is offering? Credit expansion. So, I mean, that's the problem, is debt expansion among governments has been the solution on offer from our global central bankers in light of a slowing global economy. And as a result, you now have your developed world countries swimming in debt.
Okay, well, David, I have actually gone out to eat with people who are gluten-free. And, you know, they look at the menu and they say, well, do you have anything without gluten in it? And this debt thing is reminding me of the restaurant that has everything with gluten. It's like Wheat R Us, except for in this particular case, it's Debt R Us. It's the only solution they have in their quiver.
And this is the problem we see, because liabilities on a massive scale are now common across the financial markets, and thus the interconnectedness of the global financial markets is on a scale never witnessed before. Mm. This is the real point, that correlation amongst your financial assets, correlation amongst every country in the world, is at a level we've never witnessed before. Last month, U.S. stocks dropped 6-8%, European shares over 7%, Asian markets over 8%. How about that difference between domestic versus international equities? How is it taking care of you in terms of a diversified portfolio and the salvation or the lack of risk that that's supposed to bring to the portfolio?
Well, and David, this is a paradigm that's so hard to break, because our generation growing up was always taught that diversity, 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 the efficient market theory, has been proven that if you just move money all around in different directions, at some point you're going to actually be coming out ahead most of the time. The problem with diversification in this particular case is all of these markets, like you say, are correlated. If it rolls over, they all go down.
And it's not that I have anything wrong with diversification. It's just that when we look at a diversified portfolio, you're talking about three mandates. The first mandate being liquidity, cash or cash equivalents.
Right.
The second mandate, growth or growth in income. And the third mandate, insurance, precious metals. This is a diversified portfolio. What most asset allocators do on Wall Street is pick the growth and income portion of your portfolio,
right,
and try to diversify within that space alone,
which is all correlated,
and leaving you completely under-allocated to cash and under-allocated to precious metals,
right,
and undiversified, while pretending that you're diversified because you're in international large cap or mid cap value or small cap growth. I mean, all of those things are supposed to represent diversification, and they don't. So again, Kevin, we come back to that issue of correlation amongst financial assets as a result of the ubiquity of debt. There's so much debt in the system today holding the system up. This is where we are, frankly, terrified. Terrified that the declines we've seen thus far, 8-9%,
right,
following a snapback rally here in the next few days to weeks, we could very well see, again, a 2008 repeated this year.
Well, and, you know, not that you're certain that 2008 will happen again the way that it happened before. I think sometimes we have a tendency to look back and say, okay, well, it's going to be like that, only worse. But the thing is, this time around, we have so much more inflation built into the system. You know, you've talked about this wall of money that's sitting back there that has yet to get into the system.
And it's latent. You can't see it.
Right.
Yet the smartest people I read, Kevin, every day, every week, every month are saying, listen, on the horizon, we're going to have major inflationary problems.
Right.
Guess where that's not priced in? One iota. It's not priced into the bond market. We're seeing the U.S. bond market at ridiculously low yields, at ridiculously high prices, which would assume there is no inflationary concerns whatsoever. The smartest guys in the whole investment world, the bond guys, are getting it dead wrong as they completely underestimate the probabilities of inflation over the next 2 to 3 years.
Well, David, this is a sad thing, but I think they're not the smartest guys anymore. Okay, the smartest guys are the guys where we should have been learning Chinese. I'm sorry. If we're going to learn a language, we should learn Chinese, because the Chinese and the Indians have been buying the greatest majority of gold, which is pricing in and is continuing to price in the devaluation of currencies. And you know, I just read something the other day that the Chinese buying over the last 4 months is up 700%. I mean, it's these guys are seeing it. It's not the bond guys that are seeing it. It's the Chinese.
No, in fact, you're right. It's the folks, the bond guys who are playing the old bond vigilante game are the ones who are going to get burned. The new bond vigilante game played in the gold market, the only bet that's successful against a manipulated treasury market, whether it's our treasury market or the Bund market in Germany or anywhere else, that's where the bond vigilantes will go. One last point, though, Kevin, on that 2008 global cascade in equities. We're not certain that such a fall is on the horizon now. We know that confidence is fragile. We know that systemic shocks are latent in the system. Frankly, there's too many to count. So really, to us, it's just a question of when, but not if.
Right.
And when that occurs, we will see some of the giants of finance erased from the marketplace. Counterparty dependency and the infectious nature of risk pooling, again, we're just underprepared, under-reserved, not enough liquidity. Again, what we were just describing in terms of a Wall Street asset allocation model where everything is fixated on growth and income, and you don't have enough in liquidity, and you certainly don't have enough in insurance. This is not just what Wall Street recommends to their clients. It's what they've done with their own balance sheet. And we think that the surprise will be even amongst the biggest bear community. This is the folks who are assuming a decline because we think it's going to hit them faster and more severe than they even expect.
Well, and you know, you talk about bonds being sort of the, we have mentally thought that bonds are where you go when you really don't want to take the risk in the equities market. And do you think at this point the reason rates are so low and everyone still runs to bonds or runs to the dollar every single time something happens, do you think it's muscle memory? Do you think it's just not really understanding that they're like Wile E. Coyote running and it just running right off the cliff?
Yeah, well, it's something that you and I have discussed many times, the idea of normalcy bias, that you just assume that what has been the case for 10, 20, 30 years will always be the case over the next 10, 20, 30 years, and you lack the imagination to imagine anything other than the status quo. So, you know, the pending 2012 events, the fiscal cliff, the debt ceiling wrangling, either or both, which are likely to raise the issue of U.S. fiscal sufficiency, credit quality then becomes an issue and begins to recalibrate for anyone suffering from normalcy bias. And again, the question is asked, are we actually a reliable debtor?
And David, we all know we're not a reliable debtor. We don't know how long that's going to take. But at that time, unfortunately, while we're waiting, the middle class in this country is being gutted out. You've got the elite. You've got the poor. The middle class is paying for this, and actually, they're sort of the suckers on this. You know, a friend of ours, Mark Faber, who's been on numerous times on this program, is now saying that income disparity is becoming standard issue.
Right. It's not because of unfair taxation. It's not because of anything really, you know, a greater advantage to someone who's succeeding in the corporate or capitalist world, but rather it's through Federal Reserve activity.
Well, David, talking about muscle memory, we really don't know how long we're going to have good credit in the eyes of those who are still deceived. I mean, as long as they believe we can repay and as long as they continue to go buy bonds and every time something happens and they get scared, they run back into bonds, then sure enough, you can maintain those unusually low interest rates and get the middle class. And that's what's happening right now. The middle class doesn't understand that they're being played for a sucker. The Fed is printing money and artificially keeping interest rates low, and we will pay either in the form of inflation or in the form of just negative real rate of return. And, you know, this is not a new problem. Mark Faber's been talking about it for a long time.
And I think our creditors are also aware that they're being played for the suckers. You know, the repression of interest rates and pressing rates well below their natural level is one way of getting around paying your creditors their due.
Sure.
And so you already see that, and it's apparent to everyone that the circumstances are desperate enough that we need to repress interest rates in order to keep this game going. The next step after repression doesn't work, or if it quits working, is inflation, and is the route which is most painful for the middle class. Because the one thing that you may not have in this circumstance is the ability to increase your income. There's always a benign effect with inflation. You can have massive inflation as long as you have massive wage inflation at the same time. Your wages are keeping up with the cost of goods as they're going up in value too, and that's okay. There's an offset. What is terrible is what we have today in a globalized environment where you may have domestic inflation, but if I need to change my wage or labor relationships, I'll just take those jobs and take them to another part of the world that's cheaper, which means you will not have the ability to increase your wages even as we have inflation here in the United States. This is an inflationary depression, again, where people are essentially locked in.
Well, and you know, this is not a new problem. I mean, Mark Faber even goes back and quotes a guy from 250 years ago, David Hume. And you know, Hume basically said, and this is his quote, he said, how to insert money into the economy, distribute it evenly, and avoid the inserted money from being confined to the coffers of a few persons. David, this is what you're talking about, who immediately seek to employ it to an advantage. Okay, you have an elite class right now that really doesn't care if we have inflation. They just want to make darn sure that those five banks that hold over 90% of all the derivative debt out there don't fail.
Yeah, the problem's not regarded as a problem by the few that benefit. It's the many that suffer or lose purchasing power and are essentially unable to make an adjustment that feel the pain. So, yeah, to be clear, the advantage of the 1% is conferred. It's not taken. And by that, I mean it's conferred by the Federal Reserve System.
So we can thank Keynes for that. It's the ideology of Keynes that probably is the one that is the most at fault for the decline and fall of Western civilization when it comes.
There's an irony here because while he was sort of the high priest of central bankers, we find that he was both a money and power elitist.
Right.
While he advertised himself as more of a populist, had a broadly popular sales pitch for government handouts and large spending programs. And ultimately, I take this as an insult to the intelligence of the lower and the middle class, that they're basically played as a small part in the system, a cog in the wheel, if you will, where the elite, the power and the moneyed elite gain efficiency and take power, benefiting from them just playing their role. So certainly, give them their bread and circuses and will continue to rule.
Right.
It's fascinating when you look at his life. He was the anti-capitalist who was absolutely enthralled and made his fortune in the capital markets.
Twice.
Yeah,
he made his fortune once, lost it, and then made his fortune again.
Yeah.
The whole time talking about how you really don't want that kind of capitalist greed going on.
Right, speculating in commodities on the one hand, but hating speculators publicly because it didn't fit his role as a social engineer.
Well, David, one of the things that's absolutely critical with Keynes, we talked about being able to borrow, be able to spend, but you've got to be able to keep that money moving. That's the spending part. You've got to have velocity of money. And this is a problem with Keynes.
Velocity is today dead.
If you print money and you can't get it to go anywhere, what happens?
Well, that's our issue today. And that's why, frankly, the Federal Reserve is a bit hamstrung. What do they do?
Right.
What do they do today? Because it's not enough to announce QE3. Because look at what happened with QE1, QE2, and Operation Twist. Temporary reprieve in the stock markets. Now we're coming up on the expiration of Operation Twist here at the end of the month. And guess what we're expecting?
Another one.
More intervention.
Sure.
But what benefit was it, other than a temporary reprieve in the decline in equities, of what benefit was it? We created a tremendous amount of liquidity. I mentioned this earlier, where we've taken that liquidity. The banking system has taken that liquidity, and instead of lending it out, and that being a growth component in the larger economy, they've taken it and redeposited it with the Federal Reserve. That really wasn't the Fed's idea of increasing velocity or increasing the gearing, if you will, in the overall economy.
Well, David, if you can't get it working, one of the things you can do is just give a government handout. I mean, we've got almost half of the people here in the United States in one way or another on some sort of government program.
Well, and that's the reality. If you want to increase food stamps or food sustenance programs or just some other form of government benefit, 49% today in the U.S. are on some sort of government benefit program, and that's up from 29% in 1983. Food assistance programs continue to see an increased rate of participation. We are, in essence, codifying the world of the well-off and the not-so-well-off. And those government dependents are the most reliable votes available. So the more you increase your dependencies, the more you hand out government cheese, if you will, at this point, the more you are solidifying your voter base.
So instead of printing money, just print it up in the form of food stamps, print it up in the form of government programs, just make sure that you're getting it out that way. But the problem is this, Dave. Okay, we've all heard of gap accounting, okay? Generally accepted accounting principles. It's funny that they'd use the word gap because it seems like there's a different gap that's been forming in accounting as far as our deficits go.
Well, and again, this comes back to the two issues that we face later in the year. We've got the fiscal cliff, which does relate to households are affected with government benefits perhaps being cut. You know, you got the Medicare portion, which you got doctors who are going to have a change in compensation. This fiscal cliff has many ramifications,
right,
into both the medical community, into your retired community, many swaths of people who will protest when the sting of quote-unquote austerity is felt.
Well, and that comes after the election, I should say. I mean, this is one of those things,
correct,
that's not going to affect the outcome of the election.
You mentioned GAAP as the acronym for Generally Accepted Accounting Principles, and there is a gap in the accounting. It's not an acronym, but it's actually something missing in the government's method. It's essentially ignoring the 800-pound gorilla in the room. It's called future liabilities. That's how we turn an annual deficit here in the United States of $5
trillion. Wait. $5 trillion? It's $1.5 trillion, isn't it?
$1.3 trillion.
Oh, 1.3. That's what, oh, okay, so it's 1.3.
Yeah, 1.3
right,
is what they come up with, Again, but the government gets to use a different accounting method than a publicly traded company. A publicly traded company has to account for their future liabilities, and that gets factored in. We don't have to do that. We, the people, don't have to do that. The government doesn't have to do that. We turn out a $5 trillion deficit and basically pretty up the pig, call it $1.3 trillion, call that good, and now we wrangle over the debt ceiling.
So, David, the numbers are manageable as long as the numbers themselves are managed.
As long as they're being managed.
Yeah.
Exactly. Massaged. Kevin, just boiling this down to one practical piece of advice. This was explored in brief in the Bloomberg interview that I did last week with Trish Regan.
Right.
The commentator, who was from R.J. O'Brien, said, you've got to be careful of U.S. treasuries, and you probably should own gold, because from current prices, we would expect over the next 2 years to see it trade to close to 5,000 an ounce.
That wasn't you.
It was not me. It
was
not me.
A surprise.
All that you could hear in the background was my echo, 5,000 an ounce.
Right.
No, but really, when you look at the liability structure, not just in the U.S., but globally,
right,
what the world's central bankers have done to keep this project moving forward and keep us on a growth footing, quote unquote, they have compromised our future significantly.
Well, and David, let's just look at who are being played sucker. We talked about before, but you've got these people who are accumulating gold. Central banks right now are net accumulators of gold. The Chinese are net accumulators of gold. Gosh, that's an understatement almost. But what you have with the American public, okay, you had brought this out before, the buying of gold here in America, if people think that people are buying gold in America, they're fooling themselves. I mean, we're not buying more than about twice what Turkey is buying and about 2.5 times what Vietnam is buying. The Chinese are buying it all. The central banks are buying it all. Yet we're being told by those same bankers, hey, go buy bonds.
Yeah. Well,
go buy Facebook.
Little Lucy Lemming is looking at this and saying, I'm very scared right now. I think I'd like a pool of liquidity.
Right.
Little Lucy Lemming loves liquidity. And that is in the form of 10-year treasury bonds. That is in the form of 2-year treasury bonds. That is in the form of treasury bills. So bills, bonds, and notes are what's most popular today. Exactly at the wrong time. And we, again, as we mentioned in the Bloomberg interview last week, there's more risk inherent in the bond market today than at any point, maybe last Friday, actually.
That was bad.
Than at any time in 30 years.
Yeah.
And so to see mean reversion in interest rates, to see mean reversion occur in the stock market as risk is reappraised, all of a sudden bonds are not as safe as you thought they were, and thus equities have to be revalued in a new environment of risk. We see great, great pains ahead over the next 2 to 3 years. Is that between now and the end of the year? Possibly. Probably. Perhaps. There really is no way without a crystal ball to know both the timing and the event. But we can see the events unfolding, although we do remain uncertain about the timing. Is it this year? Is it 2013? Is it 2014? The bond market and a blow up in the U.S. equity markets as a result are, in our opinion, a certainty just on the horizon.
Well, and David, talking about pain, you don't have to endure pain. If you see pain coming in a particular area, just stop touching the stove, okay? You know, it's something that every little kid has to learn the hard way once, but there are some people that have to learn it maybe a second or a third or a fourth time. But you don't have to be in the bond market. You have to have something, though, that's outside of that. This is one of the things that's coming up more and more, and that is you talked earlier about the opt-out strategy. When you're talking about opting out, you can't be waiting for somebody else's liability to pay off. And of course, that brings us back to gold. I know that's obvious.
Well, the issue, I think, can be resolved handily. If you want to read Smart Money's recent magazine, the smartest guys at Smart Money are saying you don't need to own gold.
Right.
And I would encourage all of our listeners to get a copy of Smart Money and read about why the common man is not going to own gold, because he's been told by the smartest people in the room that it's not necessary, and here are all the reasons why.
David, I read that article. It's insulting to the intelligence of anybody who reads it. It's almost as if they're speaking to children and telling them something that is absolutely untrue, but they want them to do it anyway.
So in truth, yes, it's a poor excuse for financial journalism, but it's worth all of our listeners reading it to realize what the consensus view is of
right.
owning gold. The common man is not in the market. The hedge fund community, on the other hand, is used to flying high and moving fast. They're used to taking risks, and they understand the value of a roll bar. They are, at this point, very concerned with systemic stability, and there's a growing number of sophisticated hedge fund managers who want their stake in gold. Meanwhile, the quote-unquote smart money investor, the man on the street, the hoi polloi, is setting himself up for disaster as he moves into fixed income and out of bonds. If you look at the mutual fund flows out of equities and into bonds over the last 3 years, 3 years in a row, the average man on the street has said, I'm tired of equities, I just want bonds, fixed income will do. Kevin, this is exactly what we're talking about. That's being supported by the folks at Smart Money, and the move away from gold, again, is being buttressed by the folks at Smart Money. Isn't this ironic?
So the bottom line, David, when you're coming out of paper equity and going into paper bonds, there is, at a time, somebody's going to say, wait a second, the king's got no clothes on. Let's get out of bonds. Where do they go? Well, they have to go at gold.
Yeah, and at the end of a 30-year credit cycle, the last place that you would want to go is the bond market. Even if it is rewarding for you on a short-term basis, it is a market to be traded, not invested in.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.